So where are we at the moment as a field, also as a field in jet substructure? Well, as everybody knows, 4th of July, of course, was revolutionary, right? We discovered a Higgs-like boson. Both experiments consistently. In the end, we also measured to some precision the couplings. The Higgs-like boson has been observed in very clean final states, two leptons, missing energy, photons, four leptons. However, nothing else stands out at the moment, right? So there's not a huge anomaly. There's a small excess in photon-photon. In this, but of course, I mean, it's nothing really striking or significant. So I just quote here an experimentalist who shall remain unnamed. Jet substructure is really the only field where you can actually do something new. So all these analyses, of course, are have been done by lots of people, very clean final states. But you can really contribute in the more challenging decay modes, like where the Higgs decays to BB bar, or maybe also in the TD bar Higgs final state. Maybe at some point.
And this gives us another nice resonance sum in between 80 GeV and 175 GeV.
Yeah, exactly.
Smack in the middle. Very useful. Calibrations.
Exactly.
Propons are the most exciting
part.
You get it to decay to 2.5 prongs.
However, an important thing I would like to mention is that you can actually not even avoid, if you want to do precision Higgs physics, to do jet substructure physics. Because what we observe right now is really a number of events. We observe a number of events in the photon-photon channel, four-lepton channel, two-lepton missing energy channel. But of course, if you observe a number of events, kind of this is a convolution of the production cross-section and the branching ratio. Neglect here interference effects and so on. So this is then can be depicted in the production coupling squared times the decay coupling squared divided by the total width. So now if you want to measure either the production coupling or the decay coupling, what you are limited by, you are always limited by the uncertainty with respect to the total width. So if a large uncertainty here in the denominator, you will not be able to measure the numerator very precisely. And the total width is driven by the Higgs to BB bar coupling, our largest branching ratio. And therefore, we need to measure Higgs to BB bar very precisely. So what people did here, this is the S-Fitter crew with Tillman and McElroy, Servas, and so on. They considered the cross correlations. They considered the production channels, the decay modes of the Higgs boson. And then they added the BDRS study, right? So here, W Higgs, Z Higgs, Higgs goes to BB bar. And what you can see then is that all the couplings can be measured more precisely than before. So you would say, okay, I mean, we add another channel to measure Higgs to BB bar. Of course, then the Higgs to BB bar coupling will be measured more precisely. That's logical. However, you could do also much better in measuring, for example, WW Higgs and ZZ Higgs. So it goes like from an uncertainty of 0.6, or 60% practically, down to 30%, and from 33% in WW Higgs to 24%. So in the end, if you can really ensure that you can measure the Higgs that BB bar coupling precisely, then you can improve all the coupling measurements of the Higgs boson. This is, of course, what you eventually want. Even if we don't find new physics, we know we have a Higgs-like resonance. We want to study it as precisely as possible. So you need to get these jet substructure tools working. It's about top taggers. It's about Higgs taggers. It's about maybe gluon versus quark separation. All these things will improve coupling measurements for the Higgs boson. So we are at the moment exactly at the right topic at the right time, right? And this is reflected also by the age structure of this workshop, right? So I've never seen such a young workshop where I went to. We have like, I think only, let's say a small number of people above 50, and probably on average, we have maybe an average age of 32 or something like that. So this is quite remarkable. Never been to a physics workshop like that. All right, so as a field, we also developed over the recent years quite drastically, right? So in 2008, of course, the first studies which really gave this field a kick came out, BDRS, and but also before that, old work by Mike Seymour has to be quoted, of course, 96, 97, these times. However, in the beginning, it was more like, okay, we come up with new reconstruction techniques. We know now that boosted final states are useful to study new physics. So to which phenomenological application can we apply it? What can we really explore using boosted techniques? What can we explore using jet substructure techniques? Also, there were new objects discussed, like lepton jets and so on. So later on then, this was really Fino-initiated. Later on then, experimentalists jumped on it. They provided measurements, for example, the boosted jet measurement from Tevatron, which Picas Inervo and Gilad Paris presented at Boost 2010. There were also lots of other BSM or Higgs or top-related reconstruction techniques and studies for Fino-driven studies, practically. So we gained a huge arsenal of reconstruction techniques over the years. Now, of course, we are a little bit concerned that we have so many and we need to compare them and really find out what they are good for. Then, of course, it kind of changed a little bit, because after we kind of realized that this field benefits experimental searches tremendously, people would go back and say, okay, I mean, we know we have an incentive to calculate methods more precisely because they are useful for the LHC. Now let's do it. Let's get down and check out what the theoretical uncertainties for these different methods are, what are systematic uncertainties as well, these kinds of things. So then it moved a little bit more in the theoretical direction, PQCD, SCAT, and so on, a different way to calculate things. And I think 2012 Boost reflect this quite a bit. So now, right now, this is the first workshop, I think, in 2013. And Gavin's subtitle was Back to Basics. And I think this, from his perspective, reflects exactly going back to the more elementary, more basic reconstruction techniques and evaluate the uncertainties. But on the other hand, this workshop is also driven extremely phenomenological, right? So it's not like we discussed a lot of different techniques, how to calculate things or how to evaluate theoretical uncertainties. But here we really discussed also what were the new models we might have missed, or what were new physics searches we might have not discussed. How can we improve on reconstruction techniques? So it's for both fields, kind of the Fino-driven part and the pure calculational part. A way is to say, okay, let's go back to basics and extend, and let's see what we might have missed in the beginning. I only assign here the theory calculations to the straight line and the Fino applications to the wiggly line, because I think the program for the theorists or for the theory calculations is more apparent, right? So you know what's there, you want to assess uncertainties, you have a certain procedure, you calculate maybe trimming, pruning, filtering, and so on, and background jets, maybe in signal jets, whatever, so you know practically what you're going to work within the next 1 or 2 years. For the Fino applications, it's not that clear at the moment, right? Because you don't know if there pops up a new resonance at the LHC, so you would have to think maybe in improving top reconstruction or maybe improving some other kind of resonance reconstruction. Okay, so following the left path practically, Gavin talked about relatively surprising features in the usual groomers. So there was the mass drop tagger, here the red line, which didn't show a feature if you plotted versus M over PT. Of course, you are running here at very high PT of 40 eV. But the other two grooming procedures, like pruning and trimming, they show kind of, yeah, I would say unwanted, maybe troublesome features for smaller ratios of M over PT. So I'm exactly sure if everybody knows why this comes up. So, and if everybody's working on a daily basis with pruning, so I thought I would just show what actually happened. So pruning has a two-step procedure to either recombine two subjects or reject the merging of two subjects. So one is, they shouldn't be very asymmetric in PT, and the other is they should have a large delta R separation. And this delta R separation, the D cut, is then based on this ratio M over PT. So usually there's a prefactor. I gave this prefactor 0.5 here for simplicity, and I'm using here the Cambridge-Aachen algorithm. So what you then have is practically those are nearest. They would violate this requirement. So you only veto mergings if both conditions hold true. So you merge them. They are close, you merge them. Then they are all further apart than the D cut, and now you compare. So practically now, the second requirement is always true. And now you compare the asymmetry. So this is very asymmetric. You don't merge it. You veto this merging, and you reject the softest guy. The second requirement, as I said, holds always true. You compare them. And they are so asymmetric that in the end, you would recombine them. So this is practically your constituents, your active area, if you want, of your pruned jet. Now, what Gavin says is if there's a wide-angle soft radiation sitting somewhere, this can change this D-cut parameter here. So it could contribute more to the mass than to the PT of this jet, could increase the D-cut. So what you then have is you still merge them. But now this guy is still inside the D-cut parameter. So you would combine them. And then you would observe, OK, they tend to be very asymmetric here. So they are asymmetric at vetoed, and in the end, you remain with one of these subjets practically inside this pruned jet. So this is what you then observe, right? So you see this shifting to a lower M over PT ratio. And what Gavin then says is you can cure this behavior by saying I don't want only have one of these subjects inside my pruned jet, but I want to have at least two. So I require a merging of two of these subjects. This kills, of course, the whole lower part here, but in the end, you have a very nice shape for this pruning procedure. Practically, now you promote this groomer to a tagger because you really get rid of lots of these unwanted, very QCD-like recombinations. So here, a theory calculation or a joint effort of theorists doing a calculation and assessing calculating precisely methods has led to an improvement, to practically a promotion of a groomer to a tagger. So this was one thing which has been shown. Yan-Tao Wang then, in his discussion session, showed here a huge table, right? So what we are trying to do now, and as I just outlined in the beginning, we have lots of methods, right? It's not clear we need more methods. It's not clear how we should structure them. So he came up with a certain approach to structure them, how they're well understood, how they act with respect to pileup subtraction. Is it theoretically well motivated and understood, and does it have applications? So of course, this is a quite complicated table here, comparing lots of things. The point is somehow I don't think I need to go through it. So there are lots of different techniques. They have all their purpose, and they have to be studied to some extent. I'm just at the moment not so clear of how should this perform or this comparison really be done, because comparisons depend on the process you apply them to. So this is also here reflected in the comparison of top tagging from the Boost proceedings last year, right? So they perform actually very similar. Should we be surprised? I mean, in 2010, we discussed on which samples we test these taggers. We decided not to have large cones. We decided to have R equals 1.0. We decided to have relatively high PT. And we decided to have 100 GeV PT slices. Now, if you have a look at the max, the biggest opening angle of the decay product of the top B jet practically, you take the maximum of those. As soon as you go beyond 500 GeV in PT and you have a cone size of R equals 1.0, you capture practically all the radiation. The decay products will be very hard, so you will observe a three-pronged decay inside your FET jet. And of course, I mean, these taggers run practically at their smooth spots, at least the ones who were designed for high PT efficiency, so they tend to give a very good reconstruction efficiency. In the end, the grooming part here is of minor importance, although not of, of zero importance, but it's complete. It's very much the sensitivity with respect to the removal of soft radiation is very much removed compared to large opening angles, where you also might get some initial set radiation, which can also be relatively hard. So we run them in a relatively simple mode just to be able to compare to experiment, right? So we made this choice deliberately back then, and now we shouldn't be surprised that they act relatively similar. So if you want to now go further and compare these taggers, maybe you should also compare in different scenarios, maybe with more jets, maybe with larger opening angles, something like that. Okay, so of course, I mean, as this workshop is kind of driven by the goal to collect, categorize, and compare, we also discussed a lot about new physics models, right? So where can we actually apply our reconstruction techniques, our taggers, and where can we still benefit from an improved improved approach to reconstruct final states? So we talked about high multiplicity jets. Jay talked also in his talk about it. I will come back to this a little later. And then we discussed locked quark versus gluon tagging. So in previous meetings, there was a much bigger resistance against this label of calling it quark versus gluon tagging. It's more accepted at the moment, but I think we all kind of consider it as labeling a jet with a certain radiation profile as maybe being looking more quark-like in the sense versus something which is then labeled to be gluon jet, which has just a different radiation profile. So of course, people don't think it's really a quark or a gluon in the sense. But of course, we have different radiation profiles, potentially more radiation also. And based on this, we can label it. And I think it's in the experimental stages of being tested at the moment. There's also lots of scenarios in supersymmetry, RPV, R-parity violating supersymmetry, for example, which gives you lots of jets, has also been studied early on by John Ellis, Gavin Ari Rakhlev, and so on. But of course, right now, where we don't see supersymmetry popping out easily at the LHC with maybe lots of missing energy, we might also consider studying these final states. Then, of course, some are studying at the moment more challenging stellar model processes. So like in Higgs-Strahlings process, Higgs goes to glue-glue. So this sounds very challenging, to be honest, but let's see if something can be done in this channel as well. Then we discussed resolved versus boosted cases, right? So where's the transition, of course? If we go to lower PT, we usually gain in cross-section, but then maybe the background becomes bigger. So where can we make this transition reasonably, and what would be the right cuts to make this transition smoothly? Gavin also talked about it in his talk. What would be the impact of event color flow on these different techniques? This has been discussed. And what has also been outlined was kind of electroweak states from cascade decays or from electroweak decays. For example, a heavy scalar resonance decaying to lighter scalar resonances, maybe in an extended scalar sector, or even electroweak gauge bosons being shot out by Suzy cascade decays, these kinds of things. Partly has been studied, but certainly there can be done a lot more. So the question is somehow, I mean, this classification, if this is really, if it really depends a lot on the process you apply it, so then the question is if these classifications are really a good choice. So there are many methods which were actually specifically designed for a certain process. So for example, the HAPTOP tagger was not designed to work in a highly boosted environment, but it was designed to work for TT bar H with a low PT. So it's just luck practically that it works to some extent also for highly boosted cases. But then it's of course difficult to compare because other taggers are not just used, are not designed to work in a specific environment. And therefore, these classifications, these comparisons, I'm not exactly sure what they are really good for. Of course, if you then count, so pro doing this categorization comparison, if you would need to have an application-dependent component in categorizing and collecting these taggers, then of course it would be very, very difficult. You would need to have different calibrations. You would have to assess different systematic uncertainties for each process, for each tagger, and so on. So you practically then still don't know where to use it, in which environment, and which tagger would be best to use, and so on. So it will be very, very complicated. A different thing is somehow also a different categorization could be, for example, that you have, and I don't know if we need another categorization, but so a different approach could be to call this hypothesis tester versus BSM discoverer. So if you have, if you want to do a hypothesis test and you put in all the information you have, you should get a relatively good discriminative power because, I mean, just pictorially, if you have, for example, you want to discover the Higgs, and you only focus on his hair, for example, I mean, it would be easy to fake this, right? Or you focus on his eyes, similar story here, right? It would be easy to fake this as well. Only if you have all the features and textures, you can really discriminate very precisely between different hypotheses and different imposters. Now, on the other hand, maybe we want to be more agnostic in our searches. Maybe we want to look into multi-jet final states and actually just discover new physics. Then you want to be not very biased, and maybe it's good enough for you that a number of bald guys with glasses is interesting for you. So in the end, this is then the two approaches you can have, and you would, of course...
According to your examples, then we'd be in the UK.
I think I'm entitled to make this joke, though. Okay, so according to this categorization, I would just, I mean, on this, of course, you can move some of these methods left or right or so, and not, of course, a very precise categorization. So we would have something like matrix element methods on one side, where you really put in a lot of predetermined knowledge. And then you would have something which is more like self-adjusting methods, which run then over multi-jet final states, pruning, trimming, and subjets, so the number of subjets. Of course, these observables are relatively... have a small number of parameters in this sense, and therefore would serve fairly well as tools to run really over a sample you have not much control over. You don't think there's a specific scenario hiding in. Okay, so I was asked to talk 30 seconds about, and it's not more, about shower deconstruction, because Peter wants to trash it in his talk, so it's...
I'm
just briefly going through it. I was also asked by several others what this actually is. So the idea is practically you have a matrix element method which doesn't act on the fixed order matrix element, but includes matrix element information from the shower as well. So what you did then want to do is practically you have here several subjects inside your fat jet, and you want to give them a certain label, and based on this label you calculate the probability, the weight of this to have been generated from a Higgs or, for example, a gluon or maybe a top or something like that. So you have several handles to assign weights, emission probabilities, color connection, certain kinematic requirements, because you assume you know the mass of the top or also of the Higgs boson, and then you have B-tagging information. So all this will add to your overall weight of a shower history. And in the end, we build all possible combinations of shower histories and sum them up. This is what we then call, we have different hypotheses. We have a hypothesis to be originated, for example, as a Higgs boson, or being originated in a jet, in a QCD-like event, practically. So in the end, it's really just a multiplication of Sudakov factors and splitting functions for each individual shower history. Then you get an overall weight for the shower history, and you sum over all different shower histories. In the end, you would have something like this, and this can be automized, of course, and can be calculated by a computer program. And now you have Chi, and because you have here the ratio of looking more like signal event versus looking more like background event based on the discrimination, based on how we get our weights, you would have a contribution, a shape of Chi, which would look like this. So if you generate signal events, this is for the top in this case. If I generate tops and I run the hypothesis tester, I get larger Chi values. And if I run QCD background events, I get smaller chi values. And then, of course, you can cut. So at the moment, you have practically something which tells you how pure it is, how much one event looks like top, or if it looks much more like top, or it doesn't look like top at all. So you have a certain purity for your event, and then you can make, in the end, a cut. And we compared, for example, NSAP chattiness, the HapTop tagger, CMS tagger, and Johns Hopkins tagger. So for them, I didn't vary the parameters. So, of course, certainly you can gain somehow. But the points we see here are a very good agreement with the boost preceding results. And I plotted it for different PT slices, PT 500 GeV, R equals 1.0, and PT bigger than 200 GeV with R equals 1.5. So one can see that just taking the same signal acceptance, you can do by a factor 2 to 3 better than the hep-top tagger, for example. And N-sub jelliness here suffers a bit more from this large cone. So you can do quite a lot better. But of course, I mean, N-sub jelliness is maybe not really designed the way it is to work with these large cones. There's no grooming procedure, for example, incorporated. Therefore, I mean, you can certainly improve on these numbers. So they are not to be taken at face value. Okay, so this would be a kind of an example of an hypothesis tester. The other example would be maybe the number of subjects. And
if you increase your 5 GV cut to 10 or 15, how much does it change the red line?
Yeah, not much. It changed a little bit, but we did go went because so here would I think it would change more because you have just a smaller PT for the tops. For the high PT tops with more than 500 GV, it practically doesn't change at all. So you go to higher PT cuts and you still capture the decay products and the boosted radiation at least of the tops. Then you're still much better than the other taggers. Right. So the different approach would be, of course, to look into multi-jet final states. So what Jay talked about was actually to look into the hard substructure of the event, practically. So this is very close to the idea of the hep-top tagger. The hep-top tagger, and so I didn't actually want to talk about Shaw deconstruction, but I wanted to make this discrimination between a hypothesis tester and BSM discoverer explicit with using the hep-top tagger, because the hep-top tagger would also have two stages. You would break it down to a hard structure in your jet, and you don't ask about the number of these subjects, right? Could be 5, 6, 7 or something like that. And then, only then you adapt, apply something like a full information approach to really select these subjects inside the fat jet. And Jay here has a slightly modified version of the hep-top tagger's first step, where you break it down to the hard structure practically of the event. And then you have, this is practically as it works. So you want to have, you start, you kind of reverse the shower, so the reconstruction history of the jet. You break them apart. You check that they are not too asymmetric in PT. You check that it's worth following along one of these branches and consider them as a hard structure of your jet. So you break them further apart. You call this your two subjects. You do it on the other side as well. This is, of course, different compared to, let's say, BDRS or also the Hopkins top tagger, which stop after a certain number of mass drops. But here you would go to the to the hard structure of your jet all the way down. And then, for example, here you have 3 subjets in your fat jet. Now, you would have something like this. You can, instead of 13 jet events, you would have 3 jet events with 3 fat jets, and each of these fat jets would then have several subjets. Now, of course, you are in a situation where you probably have to come up with a certain small bias, of course, so you would have to make use of the fact that maybe your signal events are induced by objects which have a certain scale. So your background, although also the invariant mass of the full final state could be big, maybe they have just fewer decay products inside the fat jet, and you induce this slight bias, but this slight selection by either the number of the subjets or MJ, so the sum of the jet masses. And in the end, you can see here that you can relatively nicely discriminate between a certain signal event versus background events. Okay, so I'm running over time. So let me just quickly summarize. The jet substructure community is small. It's extremely growing, right? Last boost was like 100 participants, but it's young and energetic and remarkably active, right? In really a very, very short amount of time, like 5 years, all these techniques have found their way into the experiments, have been applied to data, have provided great results at the LHC already. So I think the motto back to basics is quite good, because I mean, we should really make sure to find out ways to figure out ways to improve the sensitivity of the LHC particularly in these final states. So FeNO initiated search strategies, improving sensitivity for the LHC, but then also going back to our methods and evaluate how well they are theoretically understood. I think this was both of this, of these aspects were a huge part of this workshop. Thank you.
So are there any questions?
Okay. Good.
Great.
Peter's up.
So yeah, Peter's up
Okay, so this was a very nice summary talk. And now I probably cannot live up to that kind of standards, but I wanted to actually not give necessarily a detailed summary from the experimental point of view. I want to also mention a few things that we haven't really discussed, which I think have been touched here and there, but may become important. So this was my original table of content, and you will through the talk that I deviated from that as usual. So this is nothing else than a very weak guideline. I appreciate the really nice results that we saw from the experiments, and I'm not going to repeat the results for searches and so forth. I'm going to show you a few little plots on what I think is the basics in the experiment, which is the performance for certain observables, which we have to look at as well. There was a discussion, actually, the very first night I arrived on the importance of the soft stuff in the event, even at high Lumi scenarios. So I dug out a few plots showing you how well we are doing with, well, modeling this. And you know that modeling the non-perturbative stuff is tuning, meaning we put the data information in. And I want to show you how well we're doing on which scales a little bit to tell you what probably the limits are in the effective use of these things. Then everybody knows now that PyLab is my baby, or the one I really like to talk a lot about, and I'm going to talk about it again. And I want to show you a little bit the method that has been touched based on the trimming-based PyLab suppression. And I found a few nice plots that we did 2 years ago, so I added this to this talk. And then I probably want to talk a little bit about what's going on in 2015 and how we deal with that. So actually, for somebody who's doing this business for 25 years or more, so I'm actually on the older, I'm probably the tail to the right in this group. I appreciate, really, that's a very young effort and a very dynamic effort. To see this is actually quite a success all by itself, right? I mean, this is a single jet mass after some substructure grooming technique. You see the W, you see the tops, full hadronic decays. This is a big success if you know a lot about detectors, not a lot about calorimeters especially. This was not clear that it would work that well. None of the methods we apply, none of the calibrations we designed actually had anything like that in mind, but it works. So that is excellent news. It reflects a lot of work for a lot of people, but I think this is a really, really good news, and it shows us that we have the right detectors to do the things. So if you look into a few more details here, and these plots are a little bit older, but I think they're very, very valid. For example, the modeling of the jet mass for some high PT jet samples. You see here that actually, the message of this plot is that the NLO type generators seem to do a little better with some of these observables than just leading order Pythia plus the tuning we do. So you see here, for example, the red is a power hack with the Pythia shower, I think. So you see that we model these things very, very well. This is a high PT jet without grooming. This is trimmed. Here the D12, same thing without and trimmed. So we actually can model the effect of the net effect of trimming on the samples is the same in data in Monte Carlo, which is extremely convenient and certainly allows us to estimate systematics in a very consistent way. But even if you go to smaller splitting scales, the modeling still is quite good, right? And this is, we are reaching regimes here where we actually enter exactly what I said before. We're entering the soft part of the event. So we're entering really the part where we had to tune our generators. I also like this plot, which is a little more complex variable versus the jet mass. Also here, the models really follow very, very well what we measure. So this is all excellent news. And I think it allows us to really understand some of the basics of what's going on in these techniques and in the observables and subjects. So some of these shapes you've seen actually depend already on the soft event. And the way we see it in Atlas is we basically have two contributions here. One is what we call the underlying event, which I think is fairly well known. So we have the parton shower in that. We have the multiple parton interactions in that, radiations. So this is the one thing we can try to, we cannot really model or calculate that well, but we can try to tune with some modelless parameterizations, as Frank Hals used to call them. So we can actually use our data to improve the description of these kinds of features. And for the underlying event, for example, well, whenever you look into flavor production, the parton shower, for example, that's still done with LEP data. There's nothing more we can use. Fragmentation and FSR is LEP data. Now, we did the tuning against the LEP data ourselves just to be consistent in our configurations. But here, step number three, that's where actually for the first time LHT data entered, which was the ISR and primordial QT, the intrinsic QT tuning, which actually is derived from jet shapes and angular correlations between jets. And then there's a tuning of the multiple parton interactions, which are soft interactions of other partons in the same two protons. So it's not pile up, it's really parton collisions in the same protons. Here we have used Atlas jet data and the min bias data for pile up. And here we're actually hitting on the very first problem with all this game. It is that we cannot tune, with many generators, we cannot tune the same parameters in both data samples.
When you say jet data there, do you mean the jet shapes?
Jet shapes. And I will show a few plots of that. So if you look at the underlying event tune, that's actually, in 2010, when we measured the first jet shapes, this is the famous rho variable, which tells you the energy containment in a narrow array, in a narrow cone radius, in the cone of narrow radius. So here you see the data compared to several Monte Carlos, and you see that we are not doing exceptionally well. I mean, for just the first shot, it's actually quite good, but it certainly is not perfect, especially, for example, Herwig is quite a ways off, and then also the different Pythia flavors are off. Perugia is actually a tune that was based on Tevatron data, so Hadron Collider data. This was our own tune, which is a little funny because we had no data, so we were tuning to Monte Carlo, but okay. So I think it was more an academic exercise. Well, once we had the data in the can, of course, we could tune to it. And tuning can only be done to unfolded distribution, right? You have to go to the truth level. We cannot tune to any experimental observables directly. So once we unfolded the data and we tuned, in this case, this was actually Pythia 6 with different PDFs. You see, we can actually describe this now very, very well. These things are not so easy to be done with data from 2011 and 2012 because of the pileup. So this is a very good application of our first data, which was very clean with that respect. Here we could actually select events with just one vertex. And we had no pileup history effects. Now, if you look at the Minbias data sample, and you ask yourself, what is the number of charged particles with PT above 500 MeV? This has also been tuned, but here you see already some problems. It's not easy to tune for these different configurations to tune, in this case, PTI-8. Right? So you see the default tunes that we started out with, 4C and 4CX were author-provided default tunes. We could improve a little bit, like the red line here. But there wasn't much. The models were pretty stressed when we tried to do that. Now, if you ask yourself, we had actually data with tracks down to 100 MeV. And there, it gets even wilder. So tuning is not only, the magic is not only in the making anything fit, it's also in the dynamic range, if you want, of the observables. And we cannot describe very well the charge multiplicity for 100 MeV tracks, or tracks above 100 MeV. We do a decent job for 500 MeV. The biggest problem is actually the correlation. This is the number of charge tracks. This is the average PT. And while for the higher end, we do pretty well, for the lower end, we just have no way of getting it. So clearly, the parameterizations that are implemented in PTI-8 in this case do not have enough phase space, do not have enough room for us, dynamic range, to tune them to describe this data. Now, you can ask yourself, is this really important? None of these tracks between 100 and, let's say, 500 MeV will generate significant detector signals in, like, 2011, 2012. The tracking cut is actually around 400 or 500, I forgot. 2011, 2012. So we don't really see that stuff. So that's the borderline. That's why I like to make the statement several times during this workshop. Maybe you should, whatever you look at particle level, you should cut at 500 MeV PT or 1 GeV PT, just to fake a little bit, not only where the limit of our modeling capabilities are, but also what the experiment does to these signals. And here, again, in this regime, we're doing quite well, actually. So now we have the soft stuff, and the soft stuff with Thorna and us mostly in form of pileup. And I'm not going to get into all the nasty details and acceptance issues that you can have with pileup, but I want to point out that pileup is the one thing where the two experiments differ extremely. If you look at the effect of pileup, you have to look into the signal shape in the calorimeters that tell you how long a residual effect of anything lives inside the calorimeter. This is ATLAS. This is about 25 bunch crossings. So if you have any deposit, you see the effect of that in a given cell for about 25 bunch crossings. That's what we call the pileup history or out-of-time pileup. This is unavoidable. But you see also that we have a shaping function which has a net integral of zero. So on average, we actually expect that all pileup contributions cancel out. Now, if you think about it in a little more detail, and this is the last detail I mentioned in this direction, if you have energy at each of these black points, then the cancellation is just the sum of the weights times the energy. If you assume that the average energy at each bunch crossing is the same, it's just the sum of the weights, it comes to zero. That's the integral of zero. Unfortunately, in 50 nanoseconds, we have energy here, 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 here. So we have a coarser sampling, if you want. That means all the time slots where there's no collision, the energy is zero. So the integral is already not perfect. If you sum up the discrete values, you end up with like 10% or so residual effect, at least. And this changes from calorimeter region to calorimeter region. But CMS is much better off, right? They have a very short integration time. So you see that they have a very fast signal. The sensitivity is about 2 bunch crossings in 25 nanoseconds. So they see barely any history. And here's also the plot why they don't like us to go to 25 nanoseconds. Because then we would put energy here. And the history effects in CMS would increase. Why we want to have the 25 nanoseconds, because we want to have this integral more perfect. So we have to come to a decision at this point, or at some point. So the effects of pileup in the both detectors is extremely different. We have a modulation of the in-time pileup signal by out-of-time pileup, which is basically non-existent in CMS. With some good approximation, you can do a particle-level study of pileup for CMS, and you get about the right answer if you put in the right acceptance cuts. For us, it's really more complex. So I'm going through a short little play here about the effect of pileup, which I tried to put on some blackboard in the last 2 days. Try to make it a little more precise, maybe, or a little more obvious. So let's assume you have a true structure in your detector. This is just some distance scale, this is some PT. And now you add pileup. So to first, these are the little yellow thingies here. Those are pileup signals. The level of pileup is a median of these yellow things to first order is given by rho. You have a fluctuation around that, and I take n times the RMS of this fluctuation. This gives you some kind of idea which signals are surviving, which signals are significant. Now, what I usually do, if I'm just blindly applying noise suppression techniques, I subtract the baseline, so this signal all goes down, and then I make a cut at this level and subtract that too, and what remains of my original jets is this. So this I could do. This is a subtraction method. This is a rather simple, straightforward noise suppression technique, which we already know doesn't work very well. Not only in the context of pileup, but also in the general context of noise suppression and calorimeters. There's another way. You could start again from this picture, but now you say, I keep everything that is above threshold, but I don't actually subtract anything. So I leave the jets like this, and I get two different pictures. Now, I wasn't very smart when I drew this, obviously, because you can actually draw, the structure is actually the same, there's just an offset added, but you can draw configurations where this is not quite the same. So it's not very educational from that point of view, but it tells you that this is an additive offset, right? So calculating this to a scale factor, you have to be careful. If you just take the scale factor of the total PT of any of these groups, it's not easy to see how that should spread pileup. Okay? And I'm not talking about substructure yet. So I'm just telling you what you could do to suppress pileup. It's quite clear. Here you have the subtracted motivated by the rho measurement. Here you have just a filter and accept everything that survives. So the first thing when you look at the data, pileup is purely experimental. So we have to do something about it. And the earlier we can do something about it, the better, right? Because we don't want to do it later. That's really painful as it is. So we want to address it at the level of the basic signal reconstructions. What the corrections that we invent to deal with this should do, well, they should get rid of any kind of baseline, that's for sure, which is basically in-time pileup, and the global event-by-event fluctuations related to this baseline. Well, FastJet gives us a beautiful tool for that. The rho measure scales extremely well with this activity. So we can actually measure it event by event. So that is our baseline. We can get it fairly nicely. What it ideally should do is also subtract local fluctuations. And here again, this is much more important for Atlas than for CMS. Because these local fluctuations are introduced by the history of what happened before. So to suppress those, that's a little more tricky. Because for those, we don't have a good measure, if you want. We have only average information about the number of interactions in a time window around the collision we record, and it's a fairly coarse measure. So this is a non-trivial attempt, and we haven't really found a good solution for that. On the other hand, we were a little smart when we designed the detector. The energy equivalent of these fluctuations is never more than 2 times the electronic noise, the basic fluctuation in the measurement. This is a design feature of Atlas. It's only broken in the forward calorimeter where the fluctuations are much larger, but that's a minor detail. So we tried, when we designed the electronic, we designed the calorimeter structures, we tried to make sure that the pileup fluctuations are not terribly. They are in the same order of the electronic noise. In 10 to the 34 at square root of S of 14, that was the design conditions. We saw that the naive noise cut took away a lot of these little structures, and some of the structures you have to keep for substructure, maybe for mass measurement, for all kinds of things. So maybe we should try to invent something that keeps smallish signals in the presence of more larger signals, which is actually something we do in the very first step of the reconstruction in topoclusters. We do not just throw away cells because they have a small signal. We always look, what is the neighboring cell doing? So we keep small signals when there's a big signal around. So this is a topological consideration. And of course, you immediately think about trimming, right? Because it kind of does it for you. And this is not a physics motivated trimming, this is a detector signal cleanup trimming. But the tool can be the same because it finds small jets for you. It collects energies around harder energies in a small radius, and you want to probably keep those. So you run the first step of trimming, no F factor or anything like that, just do the mini jet clustering if you want. Then evaluate the jets you find with respect to the pileup baseline and the noise. Doing the same cuts I had in my little graphics. You can do the cuts, you can do the, so just the filtering. That doesn't matter. That's a matter of fine-tuning, but you can do that. So we actually tested this together with Gregory Soyer and Paolo Francavilla in 2 years ago. And Gregory tested, this is a WW event sample, 10 pileup events at 14 TeV. Okay, this was where the parameters. And what he did here is, so he keeps the subjects after some trimming, following this rule, and then he subtracts also the offset that you have per subject. So if you start with just pileup, with pileup just added, you don't even see a W peak. This is particle level, right? This is not a detector. So now, if you look at the no pileup configuration, that's actually this little thing here. So just looking at the particle and the jets you can reconstruct, you don't get a very nice mass peak. You have to do a little bit more, but we know that. That's why we use trimming and stuff like that. So now you can say, I apply the filtering first, that gives you this. And if you then do the subtraction for each subject, you get actually a fairly nice mass peak. If you look carefully, the scale goes down between just the filtering and subtraction, but it has to be because you're reducing energy, you're subtracting energy. I'm not worried about scales going down. This I can understand, and this I can correct back, but I think the evolution of the peak is an interesting feature in this plot. So I did the same plot, but I did it for very high boosted tops. So it's a TT bar sample where we have a rather large Q squared if you want, and I didn't pay any attention to the generator. I used Pythia 8 because that's the one I know how to use. So it's not a physics study in that respect. So we looked for one semi-leptonic top and the other one full hadronic. We did the same game. What you see here is the yellow is the particles, pure particle level signal, including underlying event and whatnot. If you add the pileup, you get the blue curve. And if you do a trimming, according to this here, now without the subtraction, actually, you get a very nice and narrow mass peak. So this was just a first impression on how these things could work if you apply a filter which is based on a scale that comes from the outside, that comes from the soft event.
Don't you actually use that as effectively the F cut?
Yeah, this is my F cut here, this one. So I'm not subtracting, I could subtract the, I know this, so I could subtract four times the area from here, but this is what Gregory did and I didn't.
Yeah, it's basically just shifting it from F cut to PT subject.
Yeah. Also, the subject area usually, I mean, I'm actually a little bit surprised that the effect for Gregory is rather big because the subject area is small and it's a small PT offset, but you know, it's a mass calculation, so who knows. But I think this clearly shows, and this is at physics level, this is all particle level. I haven't even plugged in any any Atlas history fluctuations, blah, blah, blah. So we could redo this with clusters, with real events, fully simulated and real data, and see what happens, just as a noise suppression tool. After you have done that, you can still do more on top of the subjects that survive the first step. That is a matter of fine-tuning. So we already know, and I just noticed about 2 minutes ago, or just before I got up here, that I chose the wrong plot to show, but I took it from Marcel, so Marcel chose the wrong plot too. I didn't want to show this one. I actually wanted to show one with a groomed collection. This only shows that the effect of pileup is scaling down with the jet size. I should have done the one where we have actually grooming applied to this line, and you see we can actually mitigate the pileup effect on the measurement right away. You also see something else. You see clearly that the mass scale is dependent on the jet size. It's not a surprise either, and it's also depending on the grooming you apply. Unfortunately, yes, I brought the wrong plot. So we are not worried about here. So this is a dedicated calibration. This can be taken care of if you need to. But we like to have a very small to no slope in this direction. And this is the number of reconstructed vertices. This is the measurement of the in-time pileup in Atlas. Scales very well with it. Oh, this is data without the out-of-time pileup. So, and we are not grooming here, so it just shows you something we probably already knew. So we had a discussion this morning which took a lot of the stuff that I put on this slide away, which is, I'm actually convinced that it's very, very hard to compare exactly the same tagout configurations between Atlas and CMS. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't try, but I think we should not be surprised if the performance is non-optimal in one or the other. I think the reason for that is hopefully quite clear. We have different effects of the pileup. It's a matter of life. And we have different acceptances due to the effect of the pileup, right? Actually, the low momentum particle acceptance atlas is still very, very good, even though we have these pileup fluctuations and we could cut away. We still can see relatively reliable 500 MeV and above particles in some respect. Actually, I think if I remember correctly, for 1 GeV charged pion, we see roughly 30% of its energy in the calorimeter. So that on average, which is pretty good actually. And this rises with the momentum of the pion. So I have actually no problem if you optimize this for your detector. Because we are not working with unfolded quantities. We are not working with particle level quantities in the detector. Maybe we could get the detector out of the way. That would be ideal. That would be trying in many other scenarios, right? We give the people in the analysis, we give them a four vector for a jet, which is corrected. We give them the four vector jet and the errors. So we try to shift the problem of the detector to the errors and to the resolution effects, but we try to give them a particle level information. We promised this in 2007 in Lesouch, right? That we all unfold to the particle level. That was the time when Gavin and Matteo suggested the jet definition. It was the same meeting where we said, yes, we go to particle level. And that's what we're doing for the global jet. Now, speaking of subjets, something inside the jet, this is not so obvious how to do that. Because we don't have the truth guidance. We don't really know what we're hitting, what we are supposed to hit at in a very consistent way. We know the distributions. We can compare the distributions of observables between a full sim and data. And we could unfold this distribution certainly somehow, but jet by jet, constituent by constituent, we really don't have much guidance. Jet by jet, the global jet, we have a lot of guidance. We can always compare to a full particle jet. That's the truth reference we have. So we have a little bit the same problem that missing ET reconstruction has. We don't really know which truths we are supposed to reconstruct. So it's not so easy to develop corrections. I'm not saying we should not sit down and think about it a little bit, but I think it would actually be worthwhile. It would be nice if we could take out the detector on the constituents of the jet. I'm just afraid it may not be possible in any reliable way. If we could do that, we have pseudoparticles, which are a good representation of the real particle flow, and that would be helpful. And then we can compare taggers maybe in a more consistent way. All we need to know is which is the minimum energy of the particle, which minimum energy of particle can you still see in the detector. And this we could, you know, always reduce the performance of one detector to match the other. So it would be nice to look into that, but I don't have a recipe ready. There are some ideas, and maybe we can get together one day and talk about them.
In terms of situation, is identical to comparing two top taggers, one running on Pity and one on Hurry. But
yes.
You want to do it on the same sample, so
yeah.
You have to run the tagger in the same experiment as well.
Right, and the I mean the real problem is also that I'm not so sure. Again, the lack of reconstruction goal is a problem for a cluster, right? Even for an eFlow object, you don't know what you're really supposed to reconstruct. Maybe in the eFlow case for charged particles, you'll be a little closer because you have to track, and it's a pretty good measure of what the true energy is, true momentum is. So I asked Michael to describe a little bit to you Schauder reconstruction because we had a somewhat longer discussion in one of the groups about it, and Michael was not there, and I forgot all the details. And it looks a little bit scary at first, right? We have obviously a very detailed tree where we start with the leaves and we try to go to the trunk. And it's not so obvious where in the experiment we actually start. We certainly don't start at the finest level of leaves. That's the particle level. We start somewhere in the middle. And what is not so clear either is, do we actually need to understand all at each step when we put branches together? Do we need to understand each of these recombinations in the experiment or not? Often what we do is we don't worry about that part. We're only worrying about the scoring variable, the observable we reconstruct, and try to estimate the systematics of that one and that one alone, instead of we ignore the systematics of each recombination. Again, if you would include that, you have a problem because the number of recombinations determines the error. So that is not a very impractical. In any case, I think the control of the systematics of the scoring variable needs to be understood. And I think that this is one of the bigger issues because we need to understand what we're supposed to see. And you have shown us a few shapes, so we probably have some guidance, but we have to understand how model dependent these shapes really are between several different generators and so forth and see how well the experimental data reproduces any of these distributions. We have some activity in Atlas about this. I don't know what the CMS people are looking into it. But we have some activity in Atlas, but I don't know what the status is. So a very similar problem I have is QJET. First of all, it's always funny when QJET to me sounds like we're smearing something, but we're smearing data. I admit this is the wrong picture. We're not smearing anything. We're just changing prescriptions from how you cluster. We don't really touch the signals. We could touch the signals and, you know, use always the same cluster prescription and see what happens. That's a good estimate for systematics as well, right? You could see what Monte Carlo and data is doing on the scoring variables if we just change the signals only. New noise cuts, higher thresholds, whatnot. So we have some room. I understand there is some work, some activity in Atlas, and I'm really looking forward to see first plots. We have these computing issues, I guess. So we have to be selective on where we apply this, and that's actually okay with me. Then there was another discussion which I found interesting because it wasn't really taken on. I think we all should get used to the fact that in the near future, we have to focus on the harder part of things in general. Because we won't be able to see soft particles anymore. The rise in luminosity, at least for the noise levels in Atlas, means it's the square root of the luminosity. That's the relation to the noise. So it rises slowly, but it rises. We may have to introduce reconstruction thresholds in the tracking because we have just way too many tracks. And confusions may become an issue. So we have to probably go from 500 MeV to 1 GeV. So even our precision reference that we had until end of last year may go away. So we really should try in the evaluation of any tagging substructure approach to always consider a scenario where you throw away some of the particles you get in your Monte Carlo. And I suggest to focus on cuts of 500 MeV and 1 GeV. I think that's about what we're looking at. I think for CMS with the magnetic field and the larger inner cavity radius, charge tags of probably at the minimum of 1 GeV or so in the future. So we have to really, and neutral particles probably have a very similar acceptance. They just get stuck in the dead material. We don't see them as well. So I strongly suggest that we consider the scenarios. If you bring up any argument that this introduces some kind of infrared safety or collinear safety, I tell you detectors by definition are infrared unsafe and collinear unstable at a small scale. We are summing up stuff in cells. We have thresholds which are either in the reconstruction, noise cuts, or by just the geometry of the detector, that material. It just, certain energies are just invisible to us. And this creates certainly collinear instabilities if you really think about it. And we will rise the scale. In 2015, the scale will be higher. I cannot give you a number. I tried with Tancredi a long time ago to calculate the intrinsic scale to which we are safe. And we had a guess of a few hundred MeV, which sounded really comfortable. But we could look into KT clustering and just see what the small scales, after higher reconstruction cuts, what the small scales are in the clustering. That kind of gives you an idea what the limit is to which we are unsafe. So I'm not so worried about this. This is just an effect of life, but we really need to make sure that in the evaluation of tagging at higher luminosity, that we consider the hard part of the spectrum more than anything else. And that should go in. So 2 years ago in Lesouches, we tried to kill tunes. Now, I think from this workshop, I got the idea we tried to kill observables, which is not a bad thing. I'm certainly not the right person to look into this, but from what I heard from Andrew and other people, it seems that many of the observables are just a slight variation of the same underlying dynamics, the jet mass or even the PT, which are already somewhat correlated all by itself. But we have, it would be nice to see the sets which have the largest decorrelated components, of course, gets extra information. Maybe one can think about, you know, the famous boosted diffusion trees and whatnot to evaluate these things very carefully. But I want to put a little bit of a concern here too. It's really not possible to really measure two-dimensional correlation matrices if you consider systematics. It's nearly impossible. So the problem is that you automatically add fantastically large errors. They just build up. There's nothing you can do about it. So, but what we can maybe do is we can think about what we do with other similar problems. We can think about nuisances. And we can group these nuisances into basically two groups, the one that are completely uncorrelated and the one that are 100% correlated. It would be ideal to find something in the middle, but because these choices of these groups is assumption-driven, it's probably not so very easy to do more than that. But you can come up with the least correlated set of variables and the most correlated set of variables and try to measure the nuisance profile along the nuisances in a reasonable way. That would give you any idea of correlations and probably gives you a better error on individual variables or individual observations. This is not completely deterministic. There's a lot of hand waving entering here. This is in this one. You make assumptions, and not all of them have been measured, calculated, or modeled. Sometimes you have to just go with your intuition. So but it would be nice to see what the underlying nuisances actually are for these variables that we use as score, for scoring and for jet mass, for example. I mean, we have pretty good ideas what they are, but it would be nice to write this down and maybe look at them. So this has been said now many times today and before. clearly, I think we all appreciate guidance and suggestions from phenomenology and calculations. I think these kind of workshops like Boost and the others we have do one thing, I think, that is we talk to each other. And that I think it's very important because I think we, in even more in places like Les Ouches where we actually have time to work, we can very quickly filter some of these things out and say, this is just not going to work. It would be nice to offer our friends from theory, phenomenology, a simpler, nice way of see what a detector is possibly doing to the stuff. And there are John Conway's PGD and whatever it's called is one of the ways. So it would be nice to, at the final evaluation, to plug something in which at least the cut I mentioned already is a good starting point.
Yeah, but it's going to take another John Conway to just sit down and do it themselves because there's no way either.
I'm not saying, this is where we have to work together. This is where we have to provide help. And I tried a long time ago with this radio engineering and yeah. It's terribly slow. So if I find somebody who's a little more knowledgeable in geometry and projections, please help. I mean, but we can do a few things relatively easy. We only get into trouble when we start talking about couplings of longitudinal and lateral showers and stuff like that. Then that's where the game has to stop. So, but we can do simple things.
So there's currently in PGS and in DELPS and tools like that that are available. Is that anywhere near good enough in jet structure?
I mean, there's no shower shapes included at all there.
But they put it on a grid and that's it. Better than nothing, but not.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to think for radio shower shapes. We could look into that, which is kind of data driven. Okay, so going from this workshop to the next.
Is this the official announcement?
Yes. This is at least the official poster. We're going to have Boost 2013. Dates are fixed. Location is fixed. We will send out a first bulletin next week, probably, hopefully. And the registration web pages will go live about the same time. Due to demands from the International Committee, it's not going to be in Tucson, Arizona. It's going to be in Flagstaff, Arizona, which has a more moderate climate. And the hotel has a nice swimming pool. So the one thing that you don't see here are my kids. They're going to be there. So,
all 17 of them?
No, only three.
Yeah, right.
I don't have 17. I only have 8.
Factors of 2.
Yeah. That's what's in the systematics, isn't it? It's going to be open for registration starting very, very soon. I think we're all lined up to do this. And I think we will start to talk about program probably not too soon from now, too. And of course, I really want to thank Brian and all your colleagues for doing this workshop. So it's not only very nice environmentally, so to say, I think it was very fruitful. There, even though after reviewing all the slides, I have to say there's no big conclusion, but I think it was not necessarily the goal to have that. In only 2 days, it's hard to make hard decisions and things like that. But I think a lot of aspects have been touched and a lot of interesting things have been discussed. So thank you very much for doing this. And I see you all at Boost, and I hope.